Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, and welcome to Masonic Home Companion. I'm your host for this gathering, Dale Graham. This is, and welcome especially to all of the survivors of the summer solstice. This is the 174th day of the 2013. Or 6013 Anno Lucas. It's a remarkable time to be alive. I hope you're all doing as well as can be expected under the circumstance and thriving as usual. We're going to talk today, of course, about the, as you can see from the prospectus for the show, the outline for the show, we have some interesting, I want to talk to you a little bit and ask for your help to understand entropy and whether this is something that is affecting us. And I've come up with a few more random thoughts that seem to make sense some days, and I want you to help me with this. Let me see if I can get us find out what's been going on this around this period of time in Masonic history. This is on the 17th of June in 1867, the Royal Freemasons Homes of Victoria was established. This is a rather important time. That was in the history of Australia. And I think, in all fairness, we keep history keeps throwing out to us that Australia was were largely inhabited by people taken from the prisons of London and sent to the to colonize. What I think is a tremendous unkindness, and perhaps I don't want to think that it's accurate. It's done deliberately, but at the time, just as there is are today, prisons were full of political prisoners, not pickpockets and thieves necessarily. So mixed into this crowd were, you can imagine, the intelligentsia, the people with a dissenting opinion at a time when dissension wasn't allowed. You and I enjoy it, and in fact it's entrenched in our freedom of speech and thought. Assembly is entrenched in constitution. We see, of course, a demonstration of why we need to hold all forms of authority accountable, including our governments, the police, any form of authority, intellectual authority, science, the arts. Because unless there is accountability, the authority. History teaches that his authority becomes overbearing. So we're seeing what some in North America are dealing with ethically as a need for greater security against the issue of individual right to privacy. And this is not the first time in history this has been done, always in a slightly different form. And for slightly, basically the same reason, always offering up that this is necessary for the greater good. Rather than having an authority decide that, it really is the populace. that needs to come to grips with that and determine whether, in fact, it is a valid statement. Partly the challenge comes because the authority tends to ignore the right of the individual or minimize the right of the individual and finds when you put clever people behind to substantiate an idea, no matter how incomplete it might be, they can make a credible case. If all it requires is to take a really poor idea and convince everybody that it's a brilliant idea, then we're going to be continuously prone to being misled. Eventually, this history teaches us that this does boil over into skepticism and indifference. And those two things, as you and I know as Freemasons, tend to destabilize whole populations. We do a great deal to improve quality of the experience and to keep the dialogue going so that we can put skepticism in context, not to refute it, not to criticize the person who may be feeling that they don't count in the bigger picture of things, but to keep people focused on the importance of being well informed and understanding the truth of their rights and freedoms. That dialogue between us and whatever form of organization is governing us, that we agree will be governing us. There's the rub. So if this is an unusual time, the weather is showing us that the force of history is remarkably powerful. It's humbling to see what's going on when something as simple as the rains can't be stopped. The amount of damage is just awe-inspiring. The displacement of people, you know, on one hand, you know, we all have to rush for survival, but each time, I think we can proudly say across Canada that people, we may hear, you know, people rally to support one another. The stranger reaches out. You and I try to capture that mood every day of our lives. So we don't need a calamity to encourage us to extend the hand. When we don't, and people know that you and I are Freemasons, that act of withholding is a sad commentary about the practice of Freemasonry. So to bring joy and tranquility to the world, we do what makes things a little better. We treat the stranger as ourselves. So here we come. The 24th of June is the date in which 1717, four London lodges, which had existed for some time, came together at the Goose and Gridiron Tavern. So let's get out to the tavern. I live near a place where it's an hour's drive to a proper tavern, but nevertheless, I could take my harness up the horse and cart and take half a day, and I'd get there and make it well worth my while. It's a day when those four lodges declared themselves a Grand Lodge and elected Anthony Serre as their Grand Master. So when you work that one into the conversation with the neighbors and friends this week, Anthony Serre, who's the first Grand Master? Well, at that date, the 24th of June, it was Anthony. It was Tony. And this is the first Grand Lodge in the world that we know of, I guess. Records hold, but by 1723, the new Grand Lodge had published its first rule book. Now that's pretty good. 5 years later, 1776 years later, they published the Book of Constitutions of Freemasonry and was meeting quarterly and recording its meetings. And it extended by then. You know, it started in London, city proper, and Westminster. And it was extending outside of that. And you know, we've talked before about the work of Jean de Sillier, the Huguenot, homage to my friend in Berks Falls, the Huguenot brother who pointed that out to me. And in the, it was only 1725, the Grand Lodge of Ireland was established. Now, of course, my gene pool being Scottish, rushes into nothing because somebody else does it. They think things over and reconsider on balance, make their own moves. I don't think the term peer pressure exists in that, you know, amongst the progeny of the clans. A lot of other things exist, but peer pressure, it was 1736 at the Grand Lodge of Scotland. It's like the lodges in Scotland were enormously rooted, and the need was not apparent for a greater organization because they were self-contained, firm, clear in their convictions. I put that to you. So the three home grand lodges began to take Freemasonry overseas, and the development of Freemasonry abroad mirrors the 18th and 19th century development of the British Empire. As we know from those who have attended the Sankey lecture, Building of the Empire, and by 1751, the rival Grand Lodge appeared in London. Ooh, of course it would. Let's declare, if somebody else is in the, if Coke was out there, let's make Pepsi, you know, and tweak with it. If Ford was out there, let's make General Motors. What was that? Buick and McLaughlin, wasn't it? That formed General Motors. The rival Grand Lodge appeared in London. Its original members were Irish Masons who claimed that the original Grand Lodge had made innovations. Now, this is coming from the United Grand Lodge of England. So let's take this from the source and give them credit in balance, but keep the context in mind. They dubbed the first Grand Lodge the Moderns and called themselves the Ancients. History now tells us that, in fact, the Moderns had made innovation and had reworded the Constitution almost entirely. The two existed for 63 years until, and they didn't just recognize, it was like, you go your way, we'll go ours, and that's Masonry. You want to innovate? Go ahead, but we're not going to have any of it. And eventually, you know, there was a lodge of reconciliation occurred. So 63 years, you know, in the course of history, that's a blink. And so in 1813, try and keep this in mind, that after 4 years of negotiation, the two grand lodges in England united on the 27th of December, 1813. The union led to a great deal of standardization of ritual procedures and regalia. Probably, I would say, you might agree, that this is probably the extent of standardization of Freemasonry possible around the world. Even though in the early era, there are later attempts to bring standardization everywhere, there were always and still remain today variations. There's different paths to Rome, don't they? But they all lead to Rome. And this, so you can see 63 years later, so keep those dates, you know, something there. There's another little jaw dropper when somebody looks at you and says, my goodness, you know, look at that fellow over there. He's just bloody brilliant. He's just oozing Masonic facts. Who knew that those folks lived separately for 63 years and then 4 years, sat down for 4 years and came up with something not only meaningful and enjoying things. The Ancients and Moderns. But by 1814, 647 lodges were in existence in England in the 19th century. And that's when things were expanded. It's funny. It's like people coming from other parts of the world speaking about us having an accent. We know who really has the accents, but you know, the expansion was there. By the 1900, there were 2,800 lodges, and and have been established despite losses when the independent Grand Lodges were formed in Canada and Australia. You know, we had our charters from those and from those Grand Lodges, but you know that they I think I'll say we showed the patience of Job with regards to questions we put in the requests for assistance, and time and time again, I don't know. Is it fair to say were we dismissed? There was an indifference because the thinking at the time we were working within a country and nation that still hails the notions of imperialism. Not everybody else in the world shares that same enthusiasm, particularly nations that struggle to find their own pride in a system where military dominance not only imposed the change in enforced culture, enforced language, and enforced in some places, enforced religion. But such is life, such is the past, and such is what we can learn from it. Of course, in the world wars were the stain on the conscience of humanity. 3 years after the First World War, over 350 new lodges were set up. And in the 3 years after the Second World War, nearly 600 were set up. I think, you know, what's often lost in these discussions is whether they were set up because men were mixed. You know, you were put into a mixing bowl of a military organization. And it's reasonable to think that if the guy in the bunk next to me was or the foxhole, I'd be a little more different. Was spending a long night on watch with me, we'd probably start to talk about each other, and it wouldn't be too unusual, even for the secretive Freemason to reveal to the fellow that was trying to keep both alive, that he was a Freemason, and start to talk more about it. I like to think that that the word of mouth was very powerful, and during the relationships forged in that kind of a battle are defining. It's truly defining. We have a great deal to do today, and I'm perhaps a little more thoughtful than most. I like to admit to most days of my life, the purest and most thoughtful minds are those which love color the most. John Ruskin said that. I think Mary Martin said this, we know. Stop the habit of wishful thinking and start the habit of thoughtful wishes. That's just too clever for me, I think. And I have a simple mind. People get very thoughtful when they are in cars. I no longer care for cars. I don't collect them. None other than Mick Jagger said that. But, he was a fairly bright guy, wasn't he? London School of Economics grad, I think, if I'm not mistaken. You can check on that yourself. Let me talk about the point, what was on my mind when I was thinking about this program. As you can see, those of you who have read a little bit, I was thinking about the fidelity, what we gain, the value added of Freemasonry. And it made me think about a recent program that I had a chance to, a recent lecture that was being rebroadcast. And I just felt it was one of those gobsmacking experiences listening to this physicist, none other than Leonard Susskind. This was a talk he gave in 2011, I think, at RIM Institute in Waterloo. And I listening to anybody who have a chance to ignore our physicists are, I think, fools. Foolish. Let me say foolish. Today, this isn't new. In our past, we had positions of natural philosophy. And most of the chairs of natural philosophy today are held by, around the world, are held by physicists. And it should make us wonder and think what in the world that was about. But Siskin spoke on our need to, gave this lecture to help us understand, make sense of theoretical physics. What is visible, is, as you know, only accounts for a small amount of the total matter in the universe. I guess it's easier for us to just pretend or ignore that fact. If the remainder is absorbed into black holes, has all the information contained in that matter also disappeared? It takes a little while to sit and listen to understand. Suskin is such a wonderful speaker that he helps fill in these questions. He's reading the puzzle in the audience's mind, because he realizes not everybody's a theoretical physicist, but there is something to be gained and taught. He's an incredible teacher. It all matters. Why does it even matter if we're talking about a black hole, you know, where the magnetism is so, this pull can overcome gravity? It matters because all things are affected by certain laws. Personally, until the professor enlightened me, I had understood the universe is expanding, a process that included laws of entropy, laws that hold atoms into molecular structure no longer were effective, as all matter reached a point of homeostasis. I was of a mind, an understanding that entropy meant that we reached its lowest common denominator. Everything did. That everything would spread. The properties that held things together would eventually resolve. But so much the fact that, for my surprise, listening to the professor, entropy is better explained as a loss of information. Much later, in another time frame of mind, I began wondering, and today I want to ask your help making sense of this. Over the years, has Freemasonry been expanding according to laws that are not obvious? Has Freemasonry been affected on a much smaller scale by laws of entropy? And over the years, have we lost information into some sort of black hole? Is there somewhere where valuable and vital information has been drawn? Whether we have or not, can we retrieve it? Or has it, once over that brink, disappeared? Universe of Masonic thought? Sounds a little bit far-fetched, doesn't it? We never did and could not exist in isolation. We have existed long before we were organized into bodies. But what forces influence our evolution, our expansion, and our destiny? What forces do? So if we look at, I think it's an interesting exploration that we need help with to completely understand this. So my question for you today, 174th day of the year. We've been looking at William Leslie Wilmshurst's book, The Meaning of Freemasonry, and we should talk just a little bit more about that here today. I see from the very interesting response to, we're able to count the noses of people that check in on Masonic Home Companion, and the response was to the past couple of shows has been remarkable. So of course I'm very grateful for that. We're meeting needs, and might as well shamelessly take advantage of this time and say, if you can pass this contact information on to another Mason, and from him to one other, perhaps there's a larger audience out there. I want to talk to you right now about why I think this may be useful to a lot of Freemasons, a lot of people. We existed long before we were organized, and by we, I think I want to include into that. I want to broaden the outlook of Freemasonry to define pre-initiation. The initiation process, the experience, defines us as a Mason. But the man existed prior to that. The man of ethics, the man of contemplation, the man trying to understand his nature, the man curious about meaning and curious about what it says to all of us and to him. It is, I think, context that was important. The context of a man's life that defines what he is and who he is. So we need to be able to gracefully suggest that it was great minds that were, you know, thoughtful men. Not everybody that's thoughtful is a great mind. History and hindsight will determine that, but I think it's reasonable to say that Freemasonry is clearly contemplative. But is it? I think it is. But I beginning to wonder why there's so much rending of cloth and gnashing of teeth and pulling of hair about the questions on whether we are meeting the needs of membership, whether we are offering as much as is needed to a Freemason, whether we are encouraging active engagement and participation, because I think we hit our stride in a lot of areas within Masonry, a tremendous amount of areas in Masonry. However, I think you and I can agree that Freemasonry is not so one-dimensional. It's a mosaic, I would think. It opens up questions in many different directions and does so purposefully, knowing full well that it may be beyond the scope of the human imagination of one person, may be beyond the scope of a lifetime. So that, which tells us very clearly, we need to be prepared to live as Freemasons, to exist as Freemasons, in an atmosphere of incompletion. It will always, always be that way if we are true to the core on the principles and philosophies of Freemasonry. So I don't think I even got into with you. We've gone down that road of looking at what's going on with various forms of ethics. But let's say you and I are considering ourselves ethical people. Well, what type of ethics? Oh, we do need to accept that there are normative ethics and applied ethics and descriptive ethics, you know, sort of descriptive being comparative ethics. That's the study of people's beliefs about morality. Well, I think that's partial. And applied is how moral outcomes can be achieved in specific situations. You know, what's the right thing to do? Well, when there's been a crime. And normative, about the practical means of determining a moral course of action. Now, which of these speaks to you in your mind and connects with Freemasonry? I'm thinking all three. And then meta-ethics, about the theoretical meaning and reference of moral propositions. Well, you know, what is handed to us, what more allegorical richness can we find that, well, I would say perhaps let's add a platform to craft masonry and say, well, let's take a serious look at the Scottish Rite. Did it just pop up as competition because everybody had an extra dollar and a few more nights in the, come on, you know, not so. The working is different, similar but different, as my friend Robert and my friends Robert and John might point out. The similar but different all the time. So what kind of ethics expounding on? Are we, you know, the Epicurean or the skeptic or the Stoic? You know, there's a lot of ways that we can think about this. So before I, you know, if I find the more I understand about what I don't understand, the more I know about what I don't understand, the less I'm able to feel that I can quarrel or disagree with other people's opinions. The more I try to understand that other person's opinions and try to explore from what they are saying, the form of ethics that they apply to their own life. How in the world do we come up with what's better and what's worse? How do we come up with this moral sense of high ground? And I'm not talking about people that are taught to, you know, intimidate or order or dominate other people. There's people around that are taught that purposefully and said that that's their job. And I think rightfully we probably have to have a bit of those folks running around. But whether there's a rightness to that, hell no. And those folks that where we grant them that kind of responsibility to, you know, exercise order in our larger societies, we watch very carefully. And we have this faint sense of shock when we find that they too are infallible. Well, we didn't train them to lack fallibility. You know, we train them to be realistic, to make thoughtful and be able to thoughtful decisions and to be able to defend those decisions. And that's not something every one of us could step up to the plate and do. And they're also taught internally that they're going to handle the conscience. They're going to bear the conscience of all the rest of us. When things go wrong, it's always easy to point a finger at those men and women doing the job that we've hired them to do, absolutely essential. So they know, and so do we. But let's drill down. Have another one of those conversations we may want to have inside of Lodge, but may not be there. So, you know, may not be always easy to, because in Lodge, there are people that may not see Freemasonry the way you do. And that, I think, I want to speak about in a little more clarity today. I want to talk to you about, I think, Freemasonry, and bear with me, correct me. There are people that go into it fascinated with the content of Freemasonry. There are people that go in that feel that they just have found that they belong because of the process of the initiatory process, the 3 degrees, looking beyond the, you know, at a content level, people go through the 3 degrees, perhaps, and will say, you know, that's the lifespan of a person. Meaning that in the corporeal sense, the body of a person. Well, that's the content level, you know, one-dimensional, I would say. And for those of you a little more esoteric or prone to the metaphysical, don't be scared by the word. It doesn't really mean a whole lot other than what's not seen or what's not obvious. So, is that the 3 degrees have something to do with the death of ego. And when you are dead, the ego dies. What comes when you're pulled up? You're pulled into a state of enlightenment and insight. Ever been said that way? No. So that's process. Then there's the spirituality. The spirituality of the order, the offering of Freemasonry, that is beyond the form of religion, or different than the form of forms of religion, that lets us explore all theological reasoning, that we can witness how good men of different faiths come to terms with their sense of the order of the universe and their place in it. There's different ideas about arriving at meaning. So I say to you, brethren, and guests, that Freemasonry may appeal and does appeal to people on different levels. Is there a correctness? No. Freemasonry is all-encompassing. And there's a place in Freemasonry for each of this type of person. So that means we, when we sit in a lodge, we could have, let's really oversimplify this and say that 33% are invested in content, 33% in process, and 33% in spirituality. Well, what are you going to do? That means if we focus on one element, let's say we focus on process, the other two, 66% of the lodge will be sitting there bored, wondering, gee, can I get out of here? And I wonder who won the hockey game, and I think I'll clean my golf clubs. You know, they'll be a wee bit distracted. I'm being kind to you, brethren. We're grown men, and of course, if you're talking with great enthusiasm and passion about your investment in content, we will sit attentively because we have much to learn from you. That's a simple fact, if nothing else, you know. But I suggest here is where there's been the problem that's caused us a no end of suffering that should and can be relieved if we just look at this problem a little different. The Masonic of thought addresses the elements of brotherly love, relief, and truth, you know, three principles, and their parallels in content, process, and spirituality, right? We like the fraternal order, that socialization of men who are speaking, and they're not speaking in vulgar terms. We make an effort to be a bit more of a gentleman with each other, and by God, as my witness, the ancient charters tell us how to act, explain to us how to act, whether we do or not. We can never say that the ancients didn't offer us the rules of conduct for Freemasons, because they are different than our conduct in the general public. So if we're acting casually as if this is just a public fair, perhaps we need to go back to Section 6 of your Book of the Constitution and open it and read through them. And I can't apologize that they seem dry in their content, but that's why I think if you're going to do that, we need to do that in small study groups. You read it and then discuss it. So you pull for yourself. It's not from the dominant personality in the room. You pull for yourself what the meaning is. So it's not you're a bad person because you don't get this, or you haven't snapped that up in the last couple of months, or you may not have read through it ever. It's that the information is there. But I suggest that part of the difficulty that we've experienced in Freemasonry is because we address those three elements as if they're separate. In a sense, they're like silos. You know? You hear that language? Some of you have heard that worn-out term for a long time. It's a well-used term. Silos, it's like ideas exist inside themselves and don't interact with other ideas that are existing inside of themselves. This usually comes up when there's a complaint that, you know, more could be done if there was a blending, a mixing. Well, you know, people that are seeing that are alchemists, and largely they're speculating. And largely these silos exist for some very clear reasons. So if we just ignore the evidence, we can say those kind of claims. So let's just mix it all up and something better will come about. Rarely are these claims followed up with any type of impact analysis. In other words, a discussion about what's likely to happen. So I think of pulling back that these discussions around, you know, when we address, you know, what, you know, or we're sitting down, you know, with a headache saying, why aren't our lodges full to the doors every meeting? Why do we have a smaller proportion of engagement than we would expect? You know, that because, you know, the people that are engaged are finding a fascination. And I think part of it is that we have addressed things like this. We've said, you know, there are fellows that come and that come because they like the social aspect. They like the glad handing and the backslapping and the joking, you know. And then the discussion is those are a special independent group of people, and they don't get it. All right. Then we get the discussion. They don't get they're not interested in the metaphysical spirituality, in a sense, the principles of truth, the philosophical. That's not truth or lie, that kind of thinking, but it means addresses the ideas of philosophy. So the philosophers of Freemasonry are, again, a separate group. So they have specific needs. And then the process of the order, the people that they are there, because there's this grasp of the ritual that speaks to them. Well, that's a separate group themselves, you know. We're blocked because that's the way we think, that we cannot reconcile one group with another. And I think tisk. This is where I think we can assist ourselves and Freemasonry largely, and probably should, because we have left ourselves feeling a little bit grumpy and out of sorts at times. Over-striving, you know, feeling that we've got these things that we want to do and we can never pull everybody together. Well, the common language of Freemasonry can speak to all of these elements at the same time. Each element, by addressing and acknowledging that each of them does exist, but they're each committed to common purpose. They are, after all, a Mason. And it means a different way of wording our ideas, describing our ideas, so that we can demonstrate. And any speaker, I think, would be challenged to address, to create a small talk that addresses acknowledges the existence of these different aspects and views of Freemasonry, the value of those different views. They're absolutely essential, as we know. And do we have to be hit over the head with a plumb rule to figure this one out? The secret was lost because one of those elements wasn't present. Oh, help me here. Help me. Oh, no, the secret was lost because somebody ran away with it or somebody died. Well, take a look at the text, boys. Take a look at the ideas. The secret was always shared, wasn't it? Well, bloody hell, one of us goes, I'm sharing this with both of you, okay? And all of a sudden, somebody knocks me on the head and I'm not there anymore, and the secret is lost. Well, who else in the room knows what the secret is? Well, the both of you do, but the illusion, the experience that nobody can take from you is that the secret rests between three. Aha. Content, process, spirituality. Brotherly love, relief, truth. There you go. A little obvious? All right, I know you're all out there and you're much more clever and you've thought about this and I've missed the mark again. I'm just pointing out some things that I see. When you talk to me, I listen to you. And sometimes you don't always make sense to me at the first go. But instead of just dismissing and discounting you, Freemasonry has made this easier for me. I make it my problem that somehow I'm not grasping the importance as you see it. And time and time again, when I put a little bit of, when I'm patient, I can begin not to read your mind, but begin to make sense of what you're saying so that there is a value. And man, the world looks a little different. So then, you know, I don't think it's very difficult to you just to sit back and say, now what's the world of masonry look like when you have all of these ingredients in it? Well, that's all I'm doing here with you. I'm asking you for some help. We need those elements, or the secret, the point, the genesis, the je ne sais quoi, is there. Only it's lost if we don't have the three elements, three components, three descriptors in the moment. So, got it a little bit? So I'm saying it is possible, not complicated at all, if we keep in mind the need to speak to the three levels and appeal to all the points. So, it's important. Now, that said, is Freemasonry that simple? yeah. not a bit. Freemasonry doesn't leave us anything that doesn't wrinkle the forehead and scratch the head, does it? History, the historians tell us that there was no connection between Freemasonry and the Templars and the Crusades. However, pick your school of thinking, content process or spiritualist, and maybe you're 2 out of 3, maybe you're 3 out of 3. I have no idea. Be what you are. But the value that we pull out of these things is perhaps this sense of chivalry. The Crusades are what they are. History has taught us a great deal. But to say that everybody was marching across the Europe into the East with a smile on their face and a song in their heart, I mean, give yours, come on. This was misery, forced misery. And now when we can sit back, I don't know, smugly or better qualified with the advantages of history around us and hindsight, we can look at and validate. At the time, these marches were validated for different reasons than we can apply today. But how does mankind deal with such tragedy? We sit back and shake our head and say, this is just morally bankrupt. Well, mankind, the gravity is always seemingly toward the moving away from the despot and moving more to the rights of a good life and what that requires, rights of people to live in harmony. But we move away from the despotic thinking that gave rise to this kind of vulgar statement of righteousness. And we'll go over and impose ourselves on this other group of people and we'll kill them all. Well, we resurrect something noble for the suffering of those men and women, the people, victims and soldiers alike, by defining such acts in our sense of noble justice. So it's not to trivialize it at all. It's the fact that we have to live with this part of history. So the Templars allow us to do that. If I think of the history of the Templar movement, they are drawing on the virtues, the ethics of virtue. And I think that's a lesson that is an incredibly important statement at any period in our history. How did we learn that lesson? By the vulgarity of, 5 Crusades? And is the history of the Crusade forgotten? Not as recent, within my lifetime, I've heard presidents of the United States referring to the Crusades when the discussion is around the East. So it's alive and well, depending on whether you're who won. Is there any victor? Well, the victor is humanity through the Templars, where men of any ethnicity, of any culture, of any creed or color can address and embrace the moral high ground. Can you see, you know, that this is so important to our understanding? We paid that price. What lessons can we learn from these events? Well, and how are you going to teach those lessons to our children's children's children? With some kind of, we're going to push the pain of the axe under their fingernails, bring them that, you know, that sense of pain so that they can, and then say, this is how you learn your lessons? Well, good God, what have we become? You know, let's control the limbic system of the brain a little bit. Control your passions. And look at what personality you become if that's your thinking. No, we want to teach the lessons like we do with the fables, so we can teach them to children at an early age. You know, listen to your parents because you can trust them. Respect authority and age because they have lessons to teach us. There's protection. So pick a fable. And they're there because they contain very valuable lessons. Similarly, at a higher level, we're talking about the metaphors and allegories of that are used to convey important moral issues within the orders. The fourth degree, the completion of the three degrees, as the early constitutions described it, the Royal Archmasonry, irrefutably there, and had been long before other appendant groups were twinkle in their daddy's eyes. Now it's always left worded that way, so you and I have to actually think about what in the world the point is. You're not handed the understanding. You have to work for that. Can you see the importance, the constant importance and value derived from our studies in history? Begin to get it. I hope that it's fundamental to Freemasonry. If we are to move ahead and to discover the secret, if you want to think of it in that way, the three elements of the Masonic order need to be in mind. When we are three, what does each element represent? And you know that the three change their role, don't they? Aha. Remember, the word is past. Three times three. So the idea is there's different aspects within each one of us, in you, in me, existing at the same time. And they are valid, and they're part of what makes us Freemasons. Now, I can say to you, are you and I paying enough attention to maintaining that balance? I'm thinking because we don't, my proposition is because we don't do that, because probably many of you have not had this type of discussion with anybody, except with me and all your friends in listening with us today. How do you move this forward? Well, I think that happens at an individual level. Remember, in the past, I've encouraged you to express Freemasonry by looking for the Mason in the fellow, by you included. That means we have to be a little bit mindful of ourselves as Freemasons. Oh, I know that some of you have that cloying, you know, voice that thinks you have to sound, you know, sound childish or trivial in order to make yourself, put emphasis on things. This is just grating on my nerves. Or the obsequious, in order for me to progress in Freemasonry, I have to, always be hanging around people that have some, what we perceive as some authority. Okay. It's a little tedious. Obsequious, it's called. There's other terms for it, but I'm not going to say it because those terms are only known amongst tradesmen and farmers. Not amongst. And when you're sitting down with professionals, they use different language, perhaps a little more, I don't know. I'll have a blunt way of describing what obsequious is. But I'd have to be sucking up to you to tell you the meaning of it, and I'd never do that. So you see the importance. In your mind alone, answers form to address your questions. So you have the question. You're absolutely valid. You're absolutely essential. Your way of thinking is absolutely essential. However, it is one element of three in the secret, the essence, the point. So get to the rest, huh? You're not going to pay you for doing what comes naturally to you. You have work to do. This is where we develop other skills that we need that we weren't born with. And in your mind, you're going to have questions that require answers. Find those answers. You have to search for them. Capacity and ability form those questions. Not everybody thinks on an esoteric level all the time. Come on. But you don't have to do that in order to consider ethics and philosophy or metaphysics. You don't. It's a language. It's a way of articulating an idea. So capacity and ability varies, doesn't it? And it varies over time, and it varies with experience, the different types of experience that a man has. And the question may come and go. Some think it's important, I think Freemasons do, to answer the questions of meaning while we're still alive, not when we're on our deathbed. You want to understand the meaning and purpose of life? Do it now, so it governs and influences the life that you live. I think that's pretty clear in our rituals. But Freemasonry has done this for us. We're born with this, the ability and capacity. And then we can train it. Those can be trained and taught. It's not like, well, you're born that way, you're stuck like that. Hell no. But Freemasonry, when we join this, introduces an awareness of the experience that is neither seen, it's either seen in the mind or not. Freemasonry teaches us this, introduces us to this idea that you can't always see things that are really important. Sometimes you have to begin to think and consider within your mind that there are answers inside of the symbols. That's really taking us all into a discussion of abstractionism and abstract reasoning. What's beyond the concrete world that we see? Freemasonry introduces us to the idea that, and it's either seen in the mind or not. This competing, this constant sense. Do you have that sense of that there's competitions inside of Masonic lodges? Well, that's the expression that there are egos that have not died. Unless the ego dies, what then is enlightenment? What then is insight? We can't find it. And we are brought through that ritual collectively. We die. At the hand of Masonry. Masonry helps kill ego. for a reason, for a beautiful reason. And at the same point, the mind is reborn, the body is reborn. The beauty of life can be seen. So when you think a guy at a content level has said, I've never gone through anything like this. True. This is an incredible experience. What in the world does it all mean? And the answers to that, we have fellows around that will start to speculate and help us. You know, here's what it is. This is about the life cycle. Well, yeah. If you're looking at content level, isn't it? If you look at what else is there going on? Well, the connection is this idea of the three. And the loss of one element means the loss of the secret. The secret is that, where do we hear this number repeated so many times, the three? Now tell me, am I just blowing smoke here today? Making any sense? So if any of this makes sense, just help me understand what it says to you and what it means, or what it means and then what it says. What validates us as a fraternity are the same things that we think about over why a couple marry. Why'd that couple get married? Well, you have some ideas, or, you know, they have similar, histories, or they're, there's different reasons. Well, you know, it might have been, it was encouraged by the families, and, maybe it was age and the need for companionship. When we look at it, there's many, many reasons, and all of them are right. All of them are right. If we're asking those kind of questions. The same thing about, that's what validates us as a fraternity. Those types of ceremony, we can ask why does it, what is it and why it has a history, but it means something different today than it did. And it's profound when a father asks me why his child died. What do you say? Do you offer up, he died because he had a disease, content, or the process, his little heart stopped, or do you talk about things philosophically? We all die. All good things come to an end. All life evolves. There's a season. All of the answers true? Well, we don't know, but they're all very valid and important opinions. It all depends on whether we're treating them with respect or being very glib. This is what happens when you begin to listen to you fellas. This is, it's interesting. The brethren that I meet day by day, profound, absolutely profound. It's just sometimes the simplest comments, the offhand comments, you can tell we're carrying a lot of work behind them. It's not new. Epictetus said this. He posited that the greatest good was contentment and serenity. You've heard this in some of the charges. One that particularly comes to mind that a lot of us will be hearing at this time of year. Epictetus, he was a Stoic philosopher. He was talking about peace of mind, one of the highest values. He said this is the highest value. So in order to achieve this, you needed self-mastery over one's desires and emotions. So that living, how does the line go? But rising to eminence by merit, you will live respected and die regretted. So self-mastery over one's desires and emotions leads to spiritual peace, according to Epictetus. The unconquerable will is central to the philosophy. This is known as Stoicism. Stoics. These are the Stoics. The individual will should be independent and inviolate. Should be. Don't be thinking things because somebody else tried to insert them into your frame of reference by taking apart one of your ideas. That's a skill of debate. That's the oldest, you know, even the simplest politicians notice that. Lawyers didn't invent it. So don't be drawn in by that trap. It's fascinating when you see somebody very skillfully doing it. But put that in context. They can take apart your argument, but it doesn't mean that what they're saying makes any sense or it's right. Oh my. There you go. Independent thought and it's inviolate. That's your will. Allowing a person to disturb the mental equilibrium is in essence offering yourself into slavery. How do you do this? How do you go through life receptive to new information and not becoming a slave to somebody else's will? If a person is free to anger you at will, you have no control over your internal world and therefore no freedom. Freedom from material attachments is also necessary. This is all according to Epictetus and the Stoics. If a thing breaks, the person should not be upset, but realize it is a thing that could break. Isn't that interesting? Now, what would life be like if you could do that? Oh my goodness, my precious belonging broke. Defines your thinking. Similarly, if somebody should die, those close to them should hold to their serenity because the loved one was made of flesh and blood destined to death. You find this more as you age. Children may not figure this out, although some do. Fools may not figure it out, but some may stumble to it. But the thoughtful, contemplative man begin to understand it is my nature, it is your nature. It's the nature of everything around us. Stoic philosophy says to accept things that cannot be changed, resigning yourself to existence and enduring in a rational fashion. Accept things that cannot be changed. That's the Stoic. Oh, gee, we've heard that picked up by a few other schools of thinking. Death, you're fearing something that's what? It's like air, light. It gives purpose, defines life. Eh? People do not lose their life, but instead return, for they are returning to the Creator, who initially gave it to us as a person. Epictetus said, difficult problems in life should not be avoided, but rather embraced. They are spiritual exercises needed for the health of the spirit, just as physical exercise is required for the health of the body. Challenges help exercise our spirit, our spiritual, the health of the spirit. And you see, he also stated that sex and sexual desires are to be avoided as the greatest threat to the integrity and equilibrium of a friend's mind. So he was speaking about abstinence being entirely highly desirable. He said, remaining abstinent in the face of temptation was a victory for which a man could be proud. You understand why some of the 5th century, 3rd century to 5th century BC philosophers' lessons resonated to this day, and why some of them were found to be flawed. This idea of that we see separation from our biological function being necessary. That was a particular type of thinking at the time. Does it exist today? I don't think so. Remember, this we've talked about Stoicism before, Epicureanism, you know, is a hedonist form of, we'll talk about the Epicurean again. But think about, just keep that in the back of your mind. William Wilmshurst, we can take just a little taste of that. I get the feeling that the audience out there was really finding great value with some of the contemporary issues brought forward at the ICHF conference that I talked about last week and last couple of weeks in terms of contemporary scholarship and Freemasonry. Bless their souls, bless the scholar souls. We could not function without them, my goodness. They are looking at things objectively and with critical thought. So, and keep in mind, when I'm talking about you looking for the Freemason in the man and in yourself, it's you distinguish between criticism, you know, the fragility of ego, with critical thought. You give it away. If you feel offended because of something, that's your ego giving it away. You're giving away control. The individual's will should be independent and inviolate. Should be. Whether it is or not rests with you. And then, of course, the next challenge is, does that mean I walk around with a sense of self-absorbed rightness that no other idea can permeate the membrane? Foolish. That group of people is what we describe as Toronto Maple Leafs fans. That was natural humor there, of course, being a Leafs fan. There's a rightness to it all. Anyway, I only want to give you a little taste of the Masonic pâté today. Just to savor it with your favorite beverage. I know you've got a... Have you found your glass of Kool-Aid when you sat down here? Well, if it's emptied, go and refill it and come back. Just as the show begins to wind down a little bit, until next time, I think we've got a incredible show coming up. I want to just talk to you about this. I'm distracted, but I'm sitting here looking at screens with full of information on the Renaissance. I think that it's exciting to think about what was going on with the Medici in Florence and how, that single family had such an impact on, scientific thought and the arts. Holy mackerel. And if nothing else, our Freemasonry, the study of the arts and sciences, is handed to us. Whether you do it or not, that's your limit. That's your problem. That's your issue. But you belong, as part of the Masonic order, you belong. And you are one of three. So bring it. Do your work. Hold up your end. Pull your oar. Be a good sailor. Be a good soldier. Step up to it. Be a good Mason. You can do this. You have the potential. We knew or we wouldn't have initiated you. We saw that potential. About your ego, how to kill your ego is really, really interesting. That's something maybe we can talk about at another time. But get over yourself. You're not that important in the scheme of things. Your will, the way you see the world, is absolutely fascinating. Come join the rest of us that are struggling with the same thing. That's why we have the safety and security of the fraternity to rely on, because it's so encouraging. It never lets us feel that we're alone in these struggles. We're just wrapping up a little bit about Wilmshurst, and he's talking about the qualified apprentice moving to the Fellowcraft Lodge. And it's one of great significance and one that I think was central to Freemasonry before the degree work was developed into the Hieramic allegory in 3 degrees, and the 4th degree being the Royal Arch. And I must say that repeatedly because that was the early constitution that made that mention. It is said to denote in plenty and to be illustrated by an ear of corn near a fall of water, which two objects are literally the meaning of the Hebrew word in question. It is desirable to observe, says Wilmshurst, that this is meant to be descriptive of the candidate himself and his own spiritual condition. It is he who is an ear of corn planted near and nourished by a fall of water. Man, Wilmshurst and I would have a long discussion because I had an idea that the corn was like a corn of pepper, wasn't like an ear of corn. And I could see how that could be misled. But my understanding of this has to do with the history of the Nile Valley and the repeated seasonal floods and the connection with astronomy and astrology. Not what Wilmhurst is getting at, but let me see where he's going. He's probably right. What do I know? His own spiritual growth as achieved in the apprenticeship stage is typified by the ripening corn. I like that. The real fertilizing cause of its growth being the downpouring upon his inner nature of the vivifying dew of heaven as a result of his aspirations toward the light. You aspire toward the light being in insight and enlightenment. As you grow, the idea here is that as we grow, we transcend our ego. The work appropriated to the apprentice degree is that of gaining purity and control of his grosser nature, its appetites and affections. Ego. Ego. That's the word we don't say. Here, it points it out and describes it. But this is really, this is what we're talking about. It is symbolized by working the rough ashlar, us with no control over our passions, letting others who are there, having an unstable will, other people are intruding their issues on us. It is symbolized by working the rough ashlar as dug from the quarry into due shape for building purposes. Polish, polish, polish. Where it functions, its function is to convert him, you and me, into a true die or square, meet for the fabric of the temple desired by the great architect to be built in Jerusalem. Okay, so we become a part of something, some great structure. And, of course, we're relying on provenance of Jerusalem to validate all of this. So that's necessary or not, you decide. The apprentice work, which relates to the subdural of the sense nature and its propensities being achieved, the next stage is the development and control of the intellectual nature, the investigation of the hidden paths of nature. That's the, as Wilmhurst is saying, the human psychological nature. Now, William Leslie, what did you know about the psychological nature of man in the, in your period of time? Good for you. Hidden paths of nature and science is what we investigate in this degree, isn't it? The gnosis, or the truth of self-knowledge, which pushed to its limits, the candidate is told, leads to the throne of God himself and reveals the ultimate secrets of his own nature and the basic principles of intellectual as distinct from moral truth. The point. So Wilmhurst is, you know, really, really a wonderful mind. You can see his references to bygone periods, you know. So but today we have the advantage of a secular environment. It means the individual mind, you, we're not led so much as we're given the freedom to decide. And some of us find great joy in just being led. Tell me what the best meal is. Tell me what the best car is. I don't want to have to think about it. Well, that type of thinking tends to create a sense of slavery. We've paid lessons throughout history and that have taught us the necessity of freedom of will, freedom of expression. The work of the second degree is accordingly a purely philosophical work involving deep psychological self-analysis, experience of unusual phenomena as the psychic faculties of the soul begin to unfold themselves, and the apprehension of abstract truth, formerly described as mathematics. Ah, the beautiful part of Freemasonry, mathematics, geometry, the truth. This work is altogether both beyond the mental horizon and the capacity of the average modern Mason. Though in the mysteries of antiquity, the methesis, or mental discipline, was an outstanding feature and produced the intellectual giants of Greek philosophy. Hence it is that today the degree is found dull, unpicturesque, and unattractive, since psychic experience and intellectual principles cannot be made spectacular and dramatic. The ritual runs that our ancient brethren of this degree met in the porchway of King Solomon's temple. This is a way of saying that natural philosophy is the porchway to the attainment of divine wisdom, that the study of man leads to knowledge of God by revealing to man the ultimate divinity at the base of human nature. This study of self-analysis of human nature, Plato called geometry. Earth measuring, the probing, sounding, and determining the limits, proportions, and potentialities of our personal organism in its physical and psychical aspects. There. When you read the, try reading through the second degree again. Think it through with this in mind. He's describing the point. Going a little bit beyond, going beyond content, looking at process to arrive at the third. I want to share with you a little bit of my tune. This was music created. This is the last thing this man ever wrote was recorded. And he died tragically in a plane crash right after he wrote this. See what the music says to you. Whether you feel kindly toward the instrument that was used, it says something.
Mm-hmm.